Welcome to the TFT podcast. I'm Matt. That's Ryan. Hi, Ryan.
Matt, you're just such a sexy socialite.
No, I'm not.
I played out in my mind. I thought as I was planning to say that, I could not be happier because that's what I had hoped you would say. So, guys, we're talking Chromio.
Yeah, our love's too great to attenuate.
Yeah,
that's a good lyric. I gotta give it whatever issues may emerge. I gotta give them that lyric. That is a really good bit of writing there.
Hey man, hey, stop looking over your shoulder. All right, stop looking over your shoulder and seeing that it is Chromio with their fourth album, White Women, coming up behind you. All right,
as we usually say, if you haven't heard White Women by Chromio, it's been out a month now, I think, at this point. So it's May 12th. So you've had some time to listen to it. But if you haven't listened to it yet, stop this podcast, go listen to it, and come back when you're done. We'll be back after a word from our sponsor. No, just kidding. We don't have a sponsor, but we may one day.
And that's where it'll go.
I can dream about selling out, can't I? Right? Apparently, Chromio's sold out.
Yeah, Jealous is in a commercial.
There you go. Good for them. Way to chaim all that shit.
Yes, they're in the ad for Johnny Appleseed Hard Apple Cider.
Nice.
Which is really appropriate, right?
Wow. I like to think that I would hold out, you know, to sell out. I think I wouldn't just take the first comer.
Johnny Appleseed Hard Apple Cider goes down smooth. Say you're on a yacht or maybe flying cross country on JetBlue Airways. Johnny Appleseed Cider, that hard apple cider for you.
I don't know. I heard
Squarespace.
I heard Chaim in Target and I thought that was incongruous enough. All right, so I want to
can we segue there?
I guess so. I wanted to kick it off. I had a question that I wanted to ask you, but I guess we can go a different way if you like. What's on your mind?
Well, I guess I think that, and maybe you can reframe the question around what I'm about to say. But I feel like Chaim is not a bad place to start. With Chromio sonically, because this is, I mean, in my fake Johnny Appleseed hard apple cider ad read, I kind of talked about riding on your yacht. And there is a sense in which Chromio is inhabiting a yacht rocky, soft rocky place. I mean, that I think merges a little bit with new wave and disco, right? There's kind of a late 70s, early 80s triangle of influences, a Bermuda triangle of synthesizers that they inhabit. But I think that in terms of things that we have discussed on TFT, they're probably sonically closest to Chaim in a lot of ways, and that Chaim also, I mean, there again, Chaim also has its own kind of triangle of influences, but this kind of soft rock strain, the greatest hits, the softest hits of the 70s, 80s, and today, not sure. none of that 90s shit.
No, yeah, exactly. F that from you know, Kurt Cobain came along and ruined everything, literally everything.
It's like someone yelled fire the day that Kurt Cobain in a crowded movie theater the day that Kurt Cobain died, and no one moved. Hashtag normcore.
Whereas Chaim reminds me of Wilson Phillips or, you know, stuff like that, like Chromio remind me of Michael Jackson, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's a different, I mean, I think, I don't know. I think that difference is important for me. And I guess I can segue to this, right? These Chromios, Ryan.
Yeah.
These Chromios with their, with their provocative album covers and with their sort of nerdy but sexually adventurous lyrics, with their hipster hairdos. These Chromeo, are they a novelty band?
Ooh, I see, man, you must be watching the World Cup, because I thought you were going to go one way and you went another way, and you just like discursively juked me. Yeah.
Sorry, I meant to kick the ball, not your face. But
yeah, exactly. You just like, headbutted me.
I was.
That's
listening.
An awesome question. That's
let me tell you a little story. I mean, indulge me in 2 minutes of.
It's good. I'm glad that asking a, we are at a place where asking a question is an occasion for a monologue.
Right. We're at that in our relationship and in our show. Two things happened recently that I want to talk about. One is that I found out that Weird Al announced a new record. It's not probably something that we'll cover on this show, not really up our alley for this, but, you know, I have seen Weird Al live, right? I enjoy.
And you know what? Thanks to listener Chris Morgan for putting that on our radar.
Yeah.
We appreciate that, or at least, I think it also went out through the OTI Twitter. So there's a closed informational loop, and Chris kind of reached out and put it on our TFT radar. I don't know, but Matt, you were going to also say you don't know whether it fits on the strictly speaking. On the TFT cognitive agenda.
Yeah, it's not. We're not going to do it. But on this show, I think. But Weird Al was on my mind, right?
Right.
Because I saw on Twitter and then retweeted that thing. And so I had Weird Al on the brain when I walked into Chromeo. The other thing was, as I was listening to Chromeo to prepare for this, I had this like nagging sense of deja vu. Where have I heard something that just reminds me so much of this. So I was auditioning for a national commercial. Unusually for these, there was a ton of NDA at the audition, and I couldn't. So I can't talk a lot about it, except to
no.
Say,
I know I don't want the Johnny Appleseed hard cider people on your ass.
Right, exactly. So I was auditioning for a commercial, and it was a jingle. So they emailed an MP3 along with the audition ticket that your agent sends you, and you sing along with it, and it sounded just like a Chromeo song, and it was advertising a beverage product, not Johnny Appleseed hard cider. I'm comfortable revealing at least that much, but it was right like, and the name of the product was sung in falsetto, and it had this like, oh yeah, kind of like white guy Barry White sort of vibe, which is very silly when I do it. And that was the whole point. It was a bunch of dorky guys brought in, and it was done for comic effect. But this record to me reminded me of an advertising jingle that I happened to learn when I was auditioning for a commercial out here in Los Angeles. You may have heard of it. It's in Los Angeles. Right. This record reminded me of a simulacrum of music, right? Like reminded me of something that is almost parodic. It's so genre. It is so kind of blatant about genre and influence. And so between that and Weird Al, I had novelty music on the brain.
So this is
what I wanted to ask when we were talking and setting up last night, and I said, "Oh, I have questions for you that are going to blow your mind." This was it. I hope your mind is sufficiently blown, right? Like, is Chromeo is it a novelty act? Are they? I mean, at what point are they not originators of art? At what point are they? Are they Weird Al, you know?
Well, I think I want to kind of drill down a little more into what a novelty act is. Because you talked a little bit about And actually drill down into the meaning of novelty, because there's this interesting paradox where in listening to kind of your description of what was making you feel like lumping it into novelty music is the kind of genericness and seemingly intentional kind of genericness, or almost not even genericness but nondescriptness. And I think that is, it's interesting. I mean, so I'm trying to think through the kind of etymology of novelty, because on the one hand, you know, novelty music is used to describe something that is, you know, less than substantial. But it's interesting because that there,
the mic away from you, but it turns on its head. An opposition that we would use a lot, right? Like,
right.
That is to say, artistically serious music is music that is novel in the sense
exactly.
of being in the sense of being new, and it's those people
exactly.
who are doing the same thing over and over.
That's what I was trying to kind of claw my way to. Exactly. I was trying to step my way to that. But thank you. That's exactly where I was trying to go. But how are you going to relate Crimeo to that then?
Well, it's right. So the novelty in novelty music, right, in sort of Weird Al style, and this is not to knock Weird Al. I like Mr. Al. I listen to his records once or twice each, right? Like, and that's
because the novelty wears off.
That's exactly it, right? And so I think that the novelty in novelty music is not at the level of artistic purpose. It's at the level of – it's at the experiential level of the individual song, right, where there's something shocking or unexpected or what have you in an individual track that makes you sort of set up and take notice. It diverts you. It entertains you, something like that. But, a lot of – honestly, and another guy I like and sort of respect what he's done career-wise, but like a lot of early Jonathan Coulton, same way, right? Like, once you know the joke, it's not funny that the song's about a giant squid anymore, you know?
And so that's really interesting. I'm just thinking this through, because I think then there's something else that you're saying is – so if we're – I mean, this is cool, because this is a realm of the conceptual space that we have not even started to map out yet. And because I'm thinking that – so if we're trying to think of a Venn diagram relationship between novelty music and kind of – and comedic music and comedy music, let's say, or we can try to think of a better word, how do you see those circles relating to one another?
Yeah, it's funny. It's an orthogonal axis, or it's a different dimension, right? Like, what does a song do, right? Why is a song a song? And like, I mean, just to take, you know, I don't know, like, is MIA not novelty? I mean, a lot of her songs are, she does things for shock value, right? She does things provocatively. Tori Amos, who we've talked about on this show, right? A lot of the things that she does for provocation. I mean, she has a sort of seriousness of social purpose with her provocation, but it's still, you know, it's still provocation. I mean, maybe that's where it is. Maybe it's what undergirds, what motivates the attempted provocation, right? Is it just kind of thrills, or is it some kind of larger social project, you know, whatever it is, or artistic project that has a relation to a larger sphere than just that existing between the artist and the listener, right?
Yeah, no, I think that, I mean, and just to kind of think about these kind of dimensions, you know, if there is something about the, you know, novelty as being defined by kind of a, like, sh- a, a, a relatively short half-life, right? That's something like where the impact decays almost exponentially with every subsequent listen. Then a comedic song that I think that is an interesting counterpoint actually is something like I'm on a Boat, which I've heard at karaoke enough times to know, at least in its role as a performance piece, it has some kind of a staying power, and that there is a sense in also. I mean, not only like so. Think about Venn diagrams. I always hear "I'm on a Boat" two times when I'm at karaoke and when I am on any boat ever. which are like, you know, which you know are, you know, granted relatively defined use cases.
You only do 2 days, the day you go in and the day you get out.
Exactly. But you know, but that's still, you know, there are a lot of other Lonely Island songs that that have a lot that have even less staying power than that. But then there are others that I do return to from time to time because they stand alone as songs. So I mean, I think, and the Lonely Island discography is interesting because there are songs. It varies from song to song, which are the novelty songs and which are not the novelty songs. Or there's a continuum of novelty.
Right.
There's one. It's, you know, there's at least one continuous dimension there. And then I think that this kind of, I don't know, the intentionality of novelty is interesting as well, because, you know, in terms of the it being there being a kind of a shock value, and then the shock wearing off kind of is how you would also describe, you know, one hit wonders as well, right? So not pop music writ large, but that is almost the definition of a one hit wonder.
Yeah.
Which actually then leads me to ask you a question, even though having not answered your question, except for through the process of answering it,
there are no answers to these questions. There's just more conversation.
So here's one. Is Iggy Azalea a novelty performer?
Right. I mean, right? you were talking about Chaim, and they are a great, just because of the throwback nature of this, right? Like Chromeo being sort of keyboard driven 80s music and Chaim being sort of guitar driven, slightly whiter 80s music. But Iggy Azalea, like for issues of appropriation, right? Like, let me put it another way: is there any reason besides sexism? Actually, I think there is, and we can get into it in a minute. But is there any reason besides sexism that Iggy Azalea gets raked over the coals, or Lorde, for that matter, right?
Yeah.
Like, get raked over the coals for their relationship to black culture and black and, you know, traditionally black music, right? And Chromeo don't. You know,
yeah.
Or right? Like, I'm using the British like plural collective nouns. Is there any reason for that? And I think
They are like Chromeo are standing on the shoulders of appropriating giants, right? Right. That in some ways, even though they are, you know, there are the moves here on this album where they are like, you know, pulling from early Michael Jackson or from Prince. They're also pulling from, you know, from Hall and Oates and from other kinds of this blue-eyed soul, which is so there's second-order appropriation.
Sure, I guess sort of Adele doesn't get called out for, right, doesn't get called out on racial grounds the same way that Iggy Azalea did, or Amy Winehouse or something like that, right?
Right.
I guess there is a more... rather than blue-eyed hip hop, like blue-eyed soul has a more established kind of cultural groove that it slots into.
Well, right, because I mean it is interesting, right? Is that Iggy Azalea? Apparently, we didn't have enough time on her. This is going to be to end up being Iggy Azalea Volume 2. But that. You know, rather than working off of, you know, Vanilla Ice or Eminem or Macklemore, as the inspiration. She goes back to another set of hip hop influences, sure. Right? And I think that is an interesting, right? She you know, and in part because of, you know, maybe in part because of the kind of intersectional issues, the intersections of race and gender, that that she kind of leans on, you know, rather than going with being being in blue-eyed hip hop, she kind of leans on the influences that we talked about of a certain period of pop hip hop,
yeah.
And kind of popular hip hop. I think this question of is Chromeo a novelty band is interesting, because there's one other kind of interesting thread in kind of, because at a certain point it's all novelty music,
sure.
Right? I think that there's a sense where, you know, like, go listen to there's a lot. This is really interesting, right? When did the Beach Boys stop being novelty music?
Sure.
The period of, like, is there just like, I mean, one could make an argument that in fact there is a that the Beach Boys catalog is set, an archipelago of artistic achievement in an ocean of novelty.
Yeah. That's an interesting point. Actually, like, the history of rock and roll,
yeah.
is the history of thrills. You know,
yeah.
what I mean? And like, there's actually, like, we talked about Lester Bangs when we talked about when Mark Lee and I talked about Almost Famous, right? And talked about the sort of the aspect of rock and roll as being gloriously dumb, right? As the Philip Seymour Hoffman character puts it, in that, and like, that's a kind of novelty, right? That sort of getting thrills or you know, cheap thrills or all kinds of pills to get all kinds of thrills, right? It doesn't how would that be more or less legitimate than, you know, than what we think of as like comedy novelty,
right?
Comedy novelty music. I mean, I think one thing is there's a typology of reference, right? Like Weird Al references an individual song and changes the lyrics. I don't know, Jonathan Coulton, it's more at the level of concept, right?
Yeah.
He references it, like, it's sort of, this song sounds like it shouldn't be about the thing it is. Lonely Island are referencing a, Lonely Island is kind of about a pathetic drop, right? They take a lot of genres of music known for kind of swagger and braggadocio and kind of undercut them, yeah. with sort of silly or, you know, trivial or,
right.
Humiliating things.
A good example of that is actually the recent one that was on their most recent album. And there's also a recent, I think the video version premiered when Andy Samberg hosted SNL like a month ago, which is the song Hugs, in which the joke of the, you know, the game of the song is that they take every instance of where the word fuck would be used as a verb in a sexually inclined rap song and substitute hugs. And so it's like, you know, I hugged a girl, then I hugged her sister, you know, and I don't want love, I just want hugs. And it's like, and it does exactly that, right? By taking the way that kind of casual sex is talked about and then talking about casual hugging, it moves to this level of kind of parody by exactly that kind of,
you know, Ryan,
that kind of drop.
When you hug someone, you hug everyone they've ever hugged.
Yes. I think that that's absolutely true. That's actually, those are good lessons for Chromio, because these guys are doing a lot of hugging. You know what? Part of, yeah. I think that in terms of a typology of whatever it is that we're calling it, it's not, I think novelty is, you know, like realness, multidimensional, continuous and multidimensional, or hyperdimensional. But I think that the point, one point at least on the, on this continuum of the ways in which kind of, like what is being parodied or referenced, is I find them to be quite similar to the darkness.
Huh.
And obviously the specific set of touchstones are, similar, but that there is in both a sense of, you know, distilling certain markers of a genre. And then, they're actually closer in what they're doing. In some ways, the darkness and the Chromio lie just on the, because no one would call, and maybe this is just like from background and artistic tradition, but there's kind of, I feel this intuitive sense that, The Lonely Island and Chromio and the Darkness are approaching similar things, but one coming from a music tradition and the other coming from a comedy tradition. But they're landing somewhere similar, and that they are really working in similar ways on genre conventions.
Well, I mean, we can sort of turn the camera on ourselves, right? Like, is overthinking it a novelty website? Right? Like, is TFT a novelty podcast? Like, we started as a Gossip Girl podcast, you know? And there was a certain tongue-in-cheekness. There was a certain idea that the concept was a bit of a novelty act, even though we both loved Gossip Girl very, very much.
Well, you know what? I think that one way to answer this is that there's two ways that I would answer this. I think the one way is with my... And it's probably actually – I've probably now like creatively misremembered it. But one of my favorite Onion headlines ever, which I believe was a – I don't know if it was an op-ed or what, but it was ironic porn purchase leads to unironic ejaculation.
Yep.
And I think that that's and I think another – the other thing that that it links to for me is something that I've talked about a lot on this. It was kind of introduced into our lexicon when we discussed the Hold Steady, and then I think in a subsequent week of it's one is one of my a favorite Hold Steady lyric from the song Stay Positive, which is it's one thing to start it with a positive jam and another thing to see it all through.
Uh-huh.
And I think that with a lot of these things, you may start with a novelty intention, but then it's hard to continue to be a novelty act. So I think that Weird Al is interesting in that he is parodying, in his album that is coming up. I'm sure, there will be one of three things. So here's an interesting prediction. I mean, maybe is there a track listing for this album yet? And if so,
I don't think so.
I've not seen it, so I predict there will be a version of Blurred Lines or Get Lucky or Call Me Maybe. And so let's.
Oh, I thought it was going to be Royals. I thought Royals was going to be number three on your list.
No, that's a good one too. That's and that's actually a little more current.
But
I mean, who knows?
Can you even do that anymore? Though you know what I mean, right? Because there were so many parody versions of Royals, like within half an hour of Royals dropping.
I mean, that's the thing is in the age of the internet, we are all Weird Al.
Right.
Right. That in fact it is, we live in novelty time. And that something is a trending topic and then it disappears. And so that, you know, continuing, you know, the act of the practice of holding steady means that even if you start from a novelty place, right, even if you start from the decision of we're going to play classic rock in Williamsburg, Brooklyn in 2003, or we're going to play, you know, and bring it back to Chromeo, we're going to play synthy soft rock, and we're going to make our keyboard stands into sexy lady legs that look like the lamp from The Christmas Story, which is, again, interestingly, a novelty gift, right? Or a novelty product, right? The leg that shows up in the house kind of as one of these kind of iconic scenes in the Christmas Story movie. Is it a Christmas Story? You'll shoot your eye out. Red Ryder BB gun, Johnny Appleseed hard cider. So I think that, and I guess that this links to one other kind of, we were talking about novelty as it relates to comedy and novelty as it relates to pop music in general and to kind of singles. But I think that the other space where novelty is important that we were kind of dancing around here is in hipster culture, right? That there is, in hipsterdom, there is this sense of finding the new thing. And once something is blown up, then the hipster, like a novelty seeking vulture, moves on, right?
I think that you and I can both say, because I think we can, and I will reveal this personal detail, we both went separately, you in New York and me in LA, to like Scandinavian Noma influenced, like artisanally foraged restaurants, right?
Yes.
And this trend is so over. Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, a bunch of uncooked.
Once I finished my palate, my second dessert, or maybe the petit four, then the trend was over.
Yeah. Exactly.
I experienced it, and it was over, because we are the canaries in the coal mine of coolness. The canaries in the coal mine, right? Like, we're not on the cutting edge. But once we're far enough along that, like, once we get it, it's going to blow up. It's not that we are like making it blow up, but we are we're right at that we like reside on the inflection point.
Right. I mean, yeah, that's interesting. I did. The dessert was the best part, by the way, of Fiona and my dinner at Red Medicine. It was a redwood ice.
Oh, interesting.
As you'd expect, which I think is like ice with wood shavings in it.
Yes, you know, that's interesting. They're doing actually something similar to that at WD-50 right now.
Oh, really?
Whereas at the other place in this space, there was no ice, but there was a beet sorbet.
Uh-huh.
Is that not novelty food?
Right. I mean that's sort of interesting, right? We've ended up talking about these bigger releases, these more popular things, because I think we want to engage with mass culture as well as, you know, as well as like Williamsburg Silver Lake culture. But like, we are, you know, an album oriented indie pop podcast, really, if you had to categorize us, if you put a gun to my head and said, what is TFT at its core, right? And so
then the person with the gun to your head like shoots you anyhow. Sorry, I've been watching a lot of 24.
We are part of the novelty industrial complex.
Yes, yes.
Is my,
we sure are.
Is my problem. Is my,
well, let me in this kind of complex, we'll put in the show notes. You know, so like, I'll tell you, the cutting edge is not the forage Scandinavian restaurant at which we actually ate, but it is the and I like wish I were making this up. I deep inside my heart wish I were making up about what I'm about to say. But the cutting edge of the novelty industrial complex is a little place, at least in the food space, is a little place called Montana's Trail House in Bushwick, Brooklyn, that serves, I believe, what's called like nouveau Appalachian cuisine. It's locally sourced cowboy food, including root beer braised brisket.
That sounds really good, doesn't it?
Well, this is the thing, and so and here's the interesting thing about Chromeo is that when I part of how I put Chromeo on our agenda is there's a confluence of factors, right? That as I was kind of reading the various sources that I read to kind of put together our playlist. I noticed a confluence of things. One is that I saw the Pitchfork review for Chromeo's White Women, and my first thought is, it was a respectable in the 7 range. And the thought is, I've been aware of Chromeo since about 2007, when they were novelty in the sense of the novelty industrial complex, that they were of a time where, in 2007, there have been various ways in which indie music has engaged with dance music, and in earlier, in around 2003, 2004, the dance engagement was with the hyphenated term of that day was dance punk. So this is bands like The Rapture and Chick Chick Chick, which is written as 3 exclamation points. And even kind of early LCD Sound System was in that space as well. But then by 2007, there was a few 2007 to 2009, there were a few other kind of hyphenated dance styles. One was blog house. So house music and tropes adopted by indie music, and another what is chill wave. So
are those like Tumblr core?
They're chill wave is more so. In my understanding, chill wave was a joke genre that was coined by Hipster Runoff, then became a real genre signifier that was became into use. But that like chill wave refers to bands like Neon Indian, Washed Out, and Toro y Moi. I think it's Moi or Moi. I don't know. I read it as Moi, like former Kenyan president Daniel Arap Moi. So Toro y Daniel Arap Moi, who appears on Come Alive, I think, on this album. And then the other kind of in the bloghouse space are bands like Cut Copy and I think importantly Justice, the French band that was kind of a second wave of Daft Punk, kind of Daft Punk-ish French dance music with some kind of the visual presentation of heavy metal and some of the kind of distorted sonics. And so Chromeo was in that wave of kind of the indie kids dancing. And so at that time it was novel, but then a lot of other bands that have been in this space have either been gotten cooler ratings or have really gotten firmly rejected by Pitchfork. And they, in the review of White Women, kind of talk about a degree of consistent quality in the music of Chromeo. And so as I'm seeing, like, interesting that Chromeo is still around and still actually getting a, being treated as journeyman rather than a, the flavor of the week that has become stale. Then the other thing I noticed is that the album that White Women debuted relatively high on the Billboard charts. And I think that more shows that album sales are so abysmal that if you sell like 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 albums, you'll chart. Because now they're nowhere to be found, but they charted somewhere around like 11 or 12 based on just first week sales. And I guess all of this is in responding to your what you're saying about the Montana Trail House, is that there are things that are good and catchy and appealing about Chromeo. And that are, and so it's an interesting thing where they are novelty musicians, but have kind of crossed some sort of threshold, either to having staying power, or they're in just some kind of, you know, novelty like purgatory or something like that. And I don't know if that's because of that. It's hard to know how that how that became the case. But there is definitely, while some people have moved on, you know, the kind of early adopters and the coolness vultures, their kind of following has only grown.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. How did you react, other than the kind of it feeling, it triggering your novelty radar? What were your other kind of reactions to what songs jumped out to you as being in your first couple of listens, or your first listen, what really grabbed your attention and grabbed you?
Well, a couple things did. I mean, there were the sort of sexual politics of it sort of jumped out at me, right? Like, it's I live with such a hair trigger radar.
Yeah.
And that's probably to the good, right? But you can't be in the like in the progressive space at all these days and not have a hair trigger radar. But the absolutely unapologetic objectification. Which they say is which in an interview, which we'll put in the show notes, they say is ironic, or someone claims is ironic, or is I don't know, is not to be taken at face value, or is just for fun, right? Like, I don't know, if your objectification is just for fun, then it's like what's fun about objectification? I don't know. There were. Maybe it's that I have a hair trigger for this kind of thing, but definitely noticed it. I noticed,
enumerate the things, cause I do, but I do have a let's put a pin in the list of what else you noticed.
Yeah.
Cause here's an interesting question of, you know, in terms of modes of, we talked a little bit about parody. Even if there is a parody of kind of certain tropes of soft rock and kind of disco songwriting, it doesn't seem like one of the things that is open for, like, it's, I guess the question is, what would one expect to see there's a few different kinds. So if they were parodying objectification of women, what would you expect to see? And what do we actually see?
Well, right. Right. Like, if you're making fun of racism, in what sense is that indistinguishable from racism? If you're making fun of sexism, right? Like, and I think that there's gotta be a place for satire, right? There's gotta be a place for satire and parody. It would be an impoverished representational landscape without it. Right.
Right.
And these are sort of, have been sort of prized modes of comedy and also of social commentary over the years, you know?
Right, but I guess the question is, is Chromeo having their satire cake and eating it too?
Well, is everyone having their satire cake,
yeah,
and eating it too? I mean, I get the sense so much that it's I get the sense so much that that there's so much glee taken in it, right, in the treating objects like women, man, right?
Treating objects like women.
Yeah, that's a. Don't email me if you're angry. That's from The Big Lebowski. Reference. It's ironic, everybody. It's just ironic sexism. But right, like I just want to return to the definition of irony, right? I would like to return to that. you know, from your freshman, like, literary appreciation class, right? Like, irony is that literary device where there are two – irony is the trope that sets up sort of two worlds, as it were, a world of what is expressed manifestly and a world of what is actually intended, right? And so there is sort of the Morissettian irony where a situation turns out in an unexpected way, but there is dramatic irony where a character doesn't know something that the audience knows in a work of literature, and the irony, the two worlds are generated by the character's expectations and by your more knowing expectations. And then there is verbal irony, where you say something that you don't actually mean in order to express what you actually mean, right? Now, if you say objectifying women is awesome, and you don't, and you behave as though objectifying women is in fact awesome, right? You're not being ironic. You're actually saying precisely the thing that you mean in that situation.
Well, and it's like, interestingly, I feel like the credential, it's like, no, but I obviously don't think objectifying women is awesome because I have a PhD in French literature from Columbia. So right. I obviously, you know, it's like in some ways.
Bam,
it's like,
I've read some Hélène Sisson, right? I've read my Lucia Rigoré. Woman, she writes in white ink. Booyah!
Yo, check my privilege. It's good. my privilege limit is high enough for me to sing songs about objectifying women, right? Like I'm being a little bit sarcastic, but I feel like it's kind of like that. That privilege in this case is being that male privilege is being treated as rather than something that's being examined reflexively, just the intersectionality of male privilege and kind of educational and cultural elite privilege, like, gives a synergistic effect that literally, rather than being reflexively aware of and kind of interrogated, allows you, it just gives you a pass. It gives you a discursive easy pass that you just breeze through the toll lane, rather than, to kind of cash out the metaphor, paying your dues, right? That there isn't, that you would want this, you would want there to be these that there's so much of the Chromio in the way they act and the way they talk and the way they sound that is so airtight that you don't see the ruptures or spaces of where you can kind of grab purchase, where you see that there is this the irony wiggle room, right? The ironic wiggle room of where then you see that there are these differences in intention, and it's operating in that way. And I don't know. It's
Like it's funny. Like, irony doesn't operate as a get out of jail free card,
yes, exactly,
discursively, right? Like, it actually is. Irony is usually more a get into jail free card, because when deployed, when actually deployed, right, satirically, it implicates the reader and the author, and right, it's a way of establishing guilt without seeming to, rather than being a way, rather than being a way of, like, letting you get one over those humorless feminists or you know what I mean, insert your identity political group here, right? That's not a good use of it. I wonder if a lot of this attitudinizing is undercut by being ridiculous, right? Hmm. But this seems to be kind of a sticking point in the discourse that we can't arrive at a definition of ridiculousness that sort of copes, or what we're calling novelty, I guess, that is adequate to cope with what's going on in Chromio, where there's a lot that they seem to be very sincerely into, and a lot that is, kind of a pose or kind of posturing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, at a certain point, is like, can you really? I mean, here's an interesting question: is like, what differences is it easy to discern? Other than in the kind of intention and kind of satirical intent between like Chromio and LMFAO. Uh-huh. I mean, I see them, they feel not that different. I don't know. I don't know who, like, I think they operate in, you know, slightly different spaces in the kind of worlds that they inhabit. But that there is, you know, even if, you know, LMFAO, you know, you could argue that there is a heightened or satirical intent in LMFAO's, taking of shots, everybody.
Another one you hear at karaoke a whole hell of a lot.
Well, I mean, when I'm around, yes. I am the one who shots. That's an interesting thing, right? A straight edge person singing the song shots, everybody, is ironic, you see, because I was not taking shots.
Yeah, I mean, what we're talking about, I guess, is a level of theatricality. Right. Hmm. And what I was just glancing again at the Pitchfork article while you were talking, because I'm going to include a link in the show notes. And the word shtick shows up in the Pitchfork article. That's what we're talking about with LMFAO. Right. And in the claim that the Pitchfork reviewer, whose name is Jordan Sargent, makes is no Chromio album has ever quite struck the perfect balance between playing it straight and letting the irony seep to the surface. But the bedrock of this group is its chops, the ability to write tunes good enough to justify the shtick. Right. Like, and I would argue with this dichotomy. Right. Like, I think that the sort of conversation we're embarking on, this sets up an opposition between chops and shtick. Right.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, you know, Hitler's works, Mein Kampf really has the chops to justify the shtick. Right.
Boom. Godwin.
Boom.
Right, like the idea that like there's good chops and bad shtick, and like your shtick is permissible to the extent that your chops permit it, I think is not an opposition that should go.
Well, I mean, that is why I Godwin, because it's like, well, how awesome do your chops have to be? Like, if your chops are good enough, If you max out your chops, then you get to be Hitler, right? But only then. Anything short of that, you are repugnant. But if you have maximum chops, then you can be maximum evil. Right? I mean, I'm just following the logical implications.
Right.
And if you want to make an exception to that, then I agree that there's something doesn't quite work there. There's a level of apologism there. So in terms of like what else was interesting, either musically or lyrically or at the intersection of the two, were there any songs that were for you.
I thought, like I said, I thought a lot of the lyric writing was clever. Have you ever met a frequent flyer dressed in all white attire, sipping on a Gray's papaya, want to take you higher? Like, you know, there's a lot of clever lyric writing. I thought a lot of the, like, jealous seems to kind of undercut the machismo, right? Like I don't know, the standard sort of funk, you know, or funk light, blue-eyed funk thing would be like, I never get jealous because, you know, no matter how many other guys my woman talks to, my dick is such an object of awe and wonder that I don't have to worry about her
right.
going down the block, right? You know, I thought... Sexy socialite was one of those sexy socialite was one of those troubling sexual politics things.
But
right?
he talks about socialism,
right?
So that's okay.
you're a sexy socialite. I wish you were a socialist. Instead of worrying about your name on the list, you insist, right? But let's unpack that a little bit, right? Like, that is to say, I, the man, have access to a serious realm of thought about socialism and political theory. You, the woman, are interested in a realm that is sort of trivial.
Frivolous.
Yeah, frivolous and trivial. And, your outfits tantalize, by the way, right? Like your relation to me is out of, you know, your relation to me is one of being tantalizing is one of, you know, kind of, but you're sort of young and full of promise was another line that stuck out to me in this song. You're out alone, so young and full of promise, right? Like it's interesting to say to an object of attraction, right? To a potential sex partner that like one of the things that's attractive about you is that you're full of promise, right? Like young, I get, good looking, I get, right? But
right, you know, it's basically my fair sexy socialite,
right?
Like there's definitely like a little bit of a Pygmalion complex.
Yeah, that I could be your boyfriend and your counselor because the night might damage you, you know?
Yeah, I know, you delicate little flower, right?
Exactly. You know, I don't know, yeah, frequent flyer. I thought that what was the lyric that I my love is too great to attenuate. I thought that was a pretty good lyric. But aesthetically I think it adds up to a coherent artistic project that's about nostalgia or that's about a sort of I'm not sure if it adds up to that at the, you know, at the level of lyrics, right? Because there's like there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of just plain old miso horny stuff, like, you know, let's do it in the bathroom, you know.
Right. But I think that the one that nails that together, and it actually stands out on repeated listens as being kind of very a bit different lyrically than the others, is Old 45s.
Huh.
Right. And so that's the one where the chorus really nails it, where he says, if you think romance is dead and gone, find an old jukebox full of 45s, pop a nickel in it, and it all comes back.
Yeah.
And I think that that's actually interesting because, you know, when it all comes back, it all comes back, right? Like, and I mean, it is hard because, you know, in some ways that, you know, that it actually... You know, this song has, I need to reread it. Maybe there are like the buried, hidden paternalism or objectifications, but that a lot of this is much more, I mean, as they even say, they talk about being a straight shooter. And of course, in the straight shooter cuts to the chase and asks if he could do her. P.S. he had a ring on his left hand. But I still even feel like that is played much more straight than, or it's taking a different tack than some of the other, a lot of the other songs.
Right, but, well, it's describing, I mean, it's describing in the second person. I mean, it's not sort of taking on the persona of a woman, but it's describing, a woman's frustration with dating in a way that takes that experience seriously.
Yes. Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Rather than describing the experience of a dude being horny, right, and wanting to get it on in the bathtub. In a way that
or join the Mile High Club,
right?
The bridge is really interesting, right? Boys are noncommittal, always in the middle. It bothers you a little. Why can't we be like mom and dad?
Yeah,
and I think that is really interesting. And that, like, you know, for me, the being like mom and dad again. Is something that links to, interestingly, the it's interesting because, like, our on the one hand, 45s to me makes me think a jukebox full of 45s makes me think of, like, when our moms and dads were quite young. When they were, you know, teenagers or even a little earlier, depending on how old your parents are, where your parents fall in the kind of boomer generation. And it makes me think of, you know, some of the, you know, the novelty music of early rock and roll. But then, you know, the other way in which, you know, I think, again, of being like mom and dad is like the kind of soft rock of the late soft rock, synth pop, etc. of the late 70s, early 80s, and maybe on some of the earlier albums it was stronger, but there is this piece of a Hall and Oates touchstone here, and I think of Hall and Oates because I've looked through more than one set of, you know, parents, like either my parents or friends' parents, Cognac's parents, like record collections, and almost always find Hall and Oates in there. and I feel like there are elements of kind of there's been a bit for the last few years, kind of Hall & Oates revival, right? That Hall & Oates was something that was really viewed as being corny and not great. And again, you know, that actually you'd be hard pressed to go to a karaoke session and not hear one Hall & Oates song. You know, it's Boats, Shots, and Hall & Oates. And that it's this, and that basically is like, and that is the way that masculinity has been reconstructed, right? So I think that it's, I think this song that is interestingly kind of earnest, and kind of is as close to the statement of purpose as there's going to be. And then, you know, about the nostalgia, but then, and then it all comes back, you know, you can't have, I mean, right, that the romance and this kind of in the nostalgia for romance also means a nostalgia for the unequal gender roles that implies, right? I mean, again, like,
yeah, that is to say, in this song, the woman is the guardian of sort of traditional values, hearth and home, right? You know, and acts as sort of check on the man, right? The man's sort of unchecked libido, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that is not necessarily completely progressive, even though this song is taking. Even though this song is taking a woman's experience seriously, the gender politics are not necessarily what we would call progressive.
No, I think that's right. But I think that tension is very interesting. What did you think of Ezra's interlude? Did that resonate? So this is the song that's sung by Ezra Koenig from Vampire Weekend. And interestingly, at least according to Rap Genius, that Dave One was Ezra's French TA at Columbia. which is pretty awesome.
Of course.
So, you know, it's interesting because it's a very simple, it's even described as an interlude. And it contains only of the lyrics, "I don't want to feel it for the second time, and I don't want to call you up or wait for a sign. I just can't pretend I'm going to make you mine."
Uh-huh.
And then Chromeo says, "I never want to be the last to know, so I guess I'll go back to laying low."
Yeah.
And I think that this is another song that stands out as being a bit apart from a lot of the higher tempo, the shticky songs, where there's this kind of second mode that pokes up at a few points on the album, and even if it is not totally disembedded from some of the problematic aspects of Chromeo, is a different side of that, or another facet of that. I don't know. Did anything about that song strike you?
I don't know. We talk about the problematic aspects of the albums, and I'm eager to do that. I'm also wary of it at the same time.
Of course,
because
yes.
I don't want there to be a political test, you know, for the music that I like necessarily, right? Like, and on the other hand, you know, insert all of my progressive convictions here, right?
Well, it's just like this. It's that it's not that there's a political test, but, you know, if there is an idea, if like along with the the chops, there's an idea that really resonates with you and you identify with, it's going to embed even deeper, right? That said. You know, for those of you who are listening, and if you're big Chromeo fans, I'd love to kind of hear, you know, I don't want you to this, you know, I'd be interested to hear it. It's like, oh my God, am I a terrible person for really finding Chromeo compelling? Like there may be different ways to approach this. I mean, you know, we've talked about, throughout, this of, you know, certain songs where the kind of political project, and either that's like the, you know, big kind of, you know, like MIA's kind of political project, or Kanye's kind of broader project, the Hold Steady's kind of scene politics. You know, that there are sometimes that when you kind of feel an alignment with that, it's not that it's a kind of the it's on the right side of a binary, or it's the right side of a switch, but it does in some ways that is kind of the novelty filter, like that one of the things that distinguishes so then there may be ultimately a subjective novelty, a personal novelty, whereas if it connects, if it sticks, the idea plus the music, right? So if it's just ideas, it may stick, but not in the music space. If it's just kind of a shocking idea and something catchy, it kind of lands in kind of novelty music. And if there's a kind of a core of the idea that is aligning with, you know, and again, it may not just be your sense of, you know, whatever your kind of sense of what you find kind of compelling and resonating with something that you believe in, whether it's politically, socially, personally, whatever, then it implants a bit more deeper, and it becomes something like that, something like part of one's personal pantheon of things that you return to again and again. So I don't know. And then I think that at the broader level, and so some level of that, that's going to be subjective, and you're going to have your own kind of reading of how something relates to you. And then for different artists, this happens at an intersubjective level. There becomes a kind of consensus that this, you know, band is doing kind of important work, and you have, you know, that amidst the vast oceans of novelty, you get your continents. You get your continents and islands and land masses of kind of artistic achievement. But it's, you know, that in fact that there's a lot of novelty out there. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
it's a way of kind of trying to thread this needle and understanding why the kind of the feeling that something is problematic or just not identifying with you is something to both take seriously, but also not to be totally a reason to reject something out of hand.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, and I would say to the listeners, if we have embedded ourselves in your minds somehow, and you keep coming back for more TFT podcast, and you have something to say about Chromio, you can leave a comment on the show notes or hit us up on Twitter.
At TFT podcast.
That's right.
At or just hit up all of Twitter.
Right.
Just hit up the Twitter.
The people who know
why do we only have 100 followers on Twitter?
Yeah, that's kind of why I figured the people who want to know already know.
No, listen to this. If you are on Twitter and you have never at replied us, give us an at reply. Say something to us on Twitter this week. If you're not on Twitter, you know, just give it a look. Maybe try out. Maybe join Twitter. And my goal this week is kind of converting a few more Twitter engagements. And that said, if you are one of the people at replying us, and we have a cohort where we are embedded in Twitter, you know, at reply us. Engage with us as always. We love the tweets, the mini conversations that happen 140 characters at a time. But you know, why limit ourselves?
Beyond that, you can leave a comment on the show notes for this episode. Looking ahead to the syllabus, we're kind of winding down a quarter's worth of new releases, and we might get started back. Back in the history soon, but the best place, if you want to do the reading in advance of the seminar, the best place to do that is on the best place to be notified of what we're talking about is on Twitter.
Right. But that's the other thing is, if you are getting this in a podcatcher, you know, we mentioned the show notes, but you know, do also check out www.overthinkingit.com and then click the post for the website there, because we often do post links to things that we discussed. We've started posting Spotify playlists, which is something I hope we'll do that either has the album or from last week's Iggy Azalea episode, I made a playlist of Iggy Azalea's influences. So there are a lot of there are common threads there. So there's a in terms of kind of multimedia preparation and engagement, preparation for an engagement with TFT, Twitter and the show notes at Overthinking It nicely complement one another. So if you largely live in the podcatcher space, there are a few other ways to engage with the show.
And we'll be back next week. Till then, Ryan, thank you. And listeners, thank you. It's been real.